Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast sunny morning with Plain Gardening. Sorry we missed some of the calls going out our last hour. Is Alan still on the line that had a question about watering? Charlie or Alan? No, not there. Well, Alan, if you get a chance, give us a call back. I'd love to talk about watering your fruit trees. Dan sent us in a picture of the squash vine borer. And it is an important pest this time of year. It gets to be a problem. The problem in Mobile is that it comes so early. Dan, the fact that you got this far along in Mobile is really quite exceptional, I'll just have to say, because squash vine borers can really hit those plants very early here. It is very hard to control squash vine borers. It's very hard to do. You could put a net over your, a cloth over your squash, which is a big pain. When you start seeing the squash vine borer moss show up, you can prevent her from laying eggs, but then you reduce the sunlight. It just creates all sorts of other problems. Then you don't get pollination from the bees because the bees can't get to it. It's not an easy deal. And she lays, the squash vine borer is a moth. She lays her eggs on the stem. She lays multiple eggs on the stem. It takes a long time for those eggs to hatch. If you manage to spot the eggs, which is doable, I've done it, and it's easy to do, you can pick them off. But after a while, you know, you get tired of doing it. You just get tired of picking the eggs off. There aren't really any ovicides that kill the eggs. They're well protected. And as soon as those eggs hatch, the worm drills in. Within a day, the worm is drilling into the stem of that squash, and he's inside the stem. And you can't kill him with an insecticide. You can't kill him with an insecticide unless it's a systemic insecticide, and that's not good for you. Then you can't eat the squash because the insecticide is then in the squash. Just something to watch out for when you're eating squash. But here's the fun part, and this is the important part, and we remind people of this all the time. If the stem is solid, stems that are more solid and harder to penetrate, they are very resistant to squash vine borer. Yellow squash and zucchini are the most susceptible. Well, that's not true. Pumpkins are even more susceptible. But yellow squash and zucchini are very susceptible to squash vine borers. And so the squash vine borer gets in. The stems are hollow. They get in. They just eat the stems from the inside out. It's great. If you can find a squash, wouldn't it be great to have a squash that had a solid stem that really can't be as susceptible to the squash vine borer? And yes, there are a lot of solid stem watermelons and melons aren't as susceptible to squash vine borers. You're not going to see that problem. But a lot of squashes, a lot of other cucurbits, have solid stems. So that's why we highly recommend that you go with solid stem squash, like Tromboncino. That's a good one. Korean ball squash. And some others that I'm experimenting with that really make a lot of difference. Alan, boy, I'm sorry we missed last hour. What's up with your trees?
Morning, Bill. Morning. I work on the road, and when I left home, there were blossoms all over my fruit trees, citrus and everything. And I come home, and I got quarter-size fruit all over everything. And normally, when the blossoms disappear, I spray a neem oil or some kind of insecticide on the trees, like I've been told. I don't know if it's right or wrong. And now I'm home, and everything is dry and hot as it is. Is it a good idea to the spray these trees now? Is it a little too strong of being as dry and hot as it is?
I wouldn't. Let's and you're right. You're right to worry. There is what we call, to make it sound official, I'll call it phytotoxicity, but there is the problem that some sprays can interact with sunlight and make it and create problems for your plants and cause burning and this is particularly a problem during the midday. So I don't recommend using any sprays at midday during these temperatures. But the question is, why would you use neem oil? So let me just say this. If you've got citrus, I can't think of any reason that you would want to spray those trees at all. If you spray them just because you got a spray and you decide to do it, you actually can create pest problems, even with neem oil, even though it's a botanical. You can create pest problems because in spraying the tree, you will probably eliminate all of the lions and tigers that are on there eating up the bad bugs. And the lions and tigers don't reproduce very quickly. So the bad bugs, like aphids and whiteflies and anything else, they can really increase in numbers simply because you've eliminated the lions and tigers. There's not a good reason, until you see a problem, and right now we're not having whitefly problems on citrus, knock on wood. I don't know of a reason to spray the citrus. Now, peaches and pears and other things, that's a little different. Have you got, what other fruit trees have you got?
I have blueberries, figs, well, the pecan trees I'm not too concerned about, but most of the blueberries and figs I have in a grapefruit set.
Yeah, so you're good. And here's the thing. I mean, no need to spray blueberries now. There can be some reason to spray them earlier in the year if you're having problems with certain pests, but don't spray your blueberries now. And figs, man, anything that can slow a fig down is working in your favor, so don't spray a fig.
I don't need it. Spray the figs. I'm concerned that as dry as it was, that spraying the tree, like a mineral oil or something on there, would absorb into the
leaves
and not have any moisture behind it or something.
Right. Even with mineral oils, which are really safe, and particularly the new mineral oils, it's not recommended that you apply them on hot days in the middle of the day. Apply them in the mornings, apply them in the evenings. Right now, I don't know of a good reason to apply mineral oil like a horticultural oil. I don't think we're seeing any problems with white flies. If we are, I'll be sure to mention it and we can do it. But yes, you're right. Don't spray it in the middle of the day. There's always that problem with phytotoxicity with sprays in the middle of the day on particularly hot days. And why that's a problem is a little complicated. It has a lot to do with how a plant transpires. It has to do with whether the stoma are open or not, and a whole lot of other things. But at that midday heat and midday radiation can be difficult when you're putting on a spray at midday. So the heat's okay. The dryness is okay, but don't put it on at midday. Do it in the morning or the afternoon. The great thing is, I don't think you need to spray right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, just concerned about trying to keep all the, they say that the fruit gets a brown spot on it. So I was just worried about making someone.
With the mites. Yeah. Well, you're right. You're right. I wouldn't, if you were, yes. So, we could have citrus mites, and the interesting thing about citrus mites is that they don't really affect the quality of the fruit, just their cosmetic problem. I have gotten to where I just ignore them because I'm not taking my citrus to market. But the citrus mite actually doesn't have a lot of impact on the fruit. It will always be on the places where the fruit is exposed to sun. If you're worried about it, I would use a horticultural oil and use it early in the day and late in the day. And you're right, they could be developing right now, but you could put a horticultural oil on. I wouldn't use neem oil.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Right.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to hear from you. Hey, folks, we're going to be back. Got some pictures to identify, which is always fun. Give us a call. 251-591-2215. No. 343-0106. That other number won't get you anywhere.
Brave men fall.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of questions coming up. David Hubble sent me some great pictures of his melaton. It's looking beautiful. His tomatoes are looking beautiful. Yes, Dan, the gugusa squash that David has promoted and that we sing about on our show. You'll hear us sing about it sometimes. Gugusa. The gugusa squash is resistant to squash vine borer because it has harder stems. And David Hubble is a witness to that. He's grown it very successfully. And yes, Dan, what you have is a tomato fruit worm related to the corn earworm. It's about time, and we'll talk about that. You know, it's time to watch out for these guys. It's time to watch out for these guys. They're out there. So if you have any questions about it, you give us a call. We do have some callers, right, Charlie? Is that right? Annie, I'm listening. What's up? Yo,
Hello.
Annie, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you a little bit here. I was calling. I wanted to find a ground cover. Actually, it's from my mother's house in Daphne. I saw an article about a month ago on Phlox, PHLOX.
Yes, ma'am.
And I was looking for something that would be that would grow next to her house. And I know I've heard you talk about don't plant within about 3 feet, but I wanted something that would be a little closer to the house.
Yes.
Could you tell me if that phlox would work in this area?
Alabama is one of the great centers of phlox diversity in the world. It's really nice. We've got a lot of them. But the dwarf phlox that you're talking about that makes a ground cover, it actually grows wild in North Alabama, but it does not grow well at all in South Alabama. I'm afraid it won't like your soils, it won't like the moisture, and I'm afraid you're going to be very disappointed. It may survive. The foliage is going to be yellow. It's going to have a hard time competing with the weeds. You're going to be pretty unhappy with it. You're going to be really unhappy with it. So we got to find something else, but there are lots of other things. There are many other things. So you want something. How high do you want this thing?
Maybe up to about a foot.
Yeah, yeah. And do you want it to be evergreen
I would like it. It doesn't. I've had evergreen, but the flowering plant looks so pretty. I really like that as well.
Yeah, so that's good. So we knew I could tell you wanted flowers. So we got to have flowers. I'm thinking about this. Will you listen in for just a minute? So we got to the first question. I did okay. Now I'm going to think a little bit about your situation. And I'm going to, before the end of this show, I'm going to come back and make some recommendations on plants. Will you listen in for that?
Surely. Can I ask you a real quick, really, really quick, can I grow, what's the best lemon to grow in this area for a tree?
That's a wonderful question, and it has an easy answer. It's called Meyer's lemon. Which is a really a distinctive, distinctly flavored lemon, but it's the trendy lemon now. If you go to California, they're always serving Meyer's lemon drinks. Meyer's lemon is actually a cross between an orange and a true lemon. And the advantage to that is not only does it change the flavor so that the flavor is really good, the advantage is that the orange gives it hardiness. So you can actually put that lemon in the ground. And it does very well, and it survives in the ground. If you want to grow a lemon in a pot, I don't recommend Meyer's Orange. I recommend Lisbon, the old-fashioned Lisbon lemon. It does well in a pot, and you can get lemons. If you play it right, you can get lemons all year long. But if you're putting it in the ground, you want to do Meyer's lemon.
Okay. And when would I put it in the ground? What time of the year?
Well, you wouldn't want to wait too much longer. With any citrus, you always want to put them in the ground as early in the year as possible. So usually I recommend March and April, but it's okay. Not too late. Just go ahead and get it in the ground now.
No, I can wait.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much. And I'll
all right.
And
I'm all right. I'll be thinking about that.
All right. Thank
we got
so
an,
much.
Yeah. Got another caller, Charlie? Kurt, I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Bill. Good morning. say, I'm a bad one to scrounge plants when I can get them, and I was driving past a spot. I'm over in Fairhope, and somebody had taken down some sagos that looked to be maybe 3 feet, 4 feet tall, something like that, and they had just cut them off at the base, and somewhere somebody had told me, you can plant that, and it will grow even without roots. Now, the flip side question is, they also dug up the roots, and those are there with no stalk. So would that grow, either the roots with no stalk or the stalk with no roots?
Well, I would, yeah, the stalk with no roots, nah, don't waste your time.
Okay.
The roots without a stalk, now that's an interesting question. They may sprout. Given they may sprout if there are some latent buds in those roots, because of the way they form, you stand a better chance with the roots than you do with the tops. You stand no chance with the tops, zero chance. So don't waste your time. But you stand a small chance. You stand a small chance with the roots if the roots have some latent buds. I would give it a 20% chance that there are some latent buds around hiding around those roots that would have sprouted into another plant, and they may come out and sprout. Do I think this is worth a lot of your time? No, in either situation. But, you know, for the heck of it, if you want to try it, give it a shot. And I would say there's a 1 in 4 chance, let's say, that the roots themselves may have some latent buds that sprout. The best way to do it is when somebody digs up, you know, if you can find the person who did this, and next time if they want to remove some of the plants, just tell them to let you take a spade and shear off one of those plants on the edges. You just take a sharp spade, sharpen it. Actually, just take a little file, sharpen it, and just slice down through that right on the edge. Get the roots with a green top on the edges of those plants. That transplants real well. You'll do real well with those.
Okay. Is there a quick question on the roots? Is there something I can look for to identify whether there are latent buds there? Is there a way I'd recognize that?
Yeah, I think most likely you're going to see a little protuberance that looks like it might be another plant that wants to grow out from under the side, depending on the maturity of that root, and it will just be a little protuberance right there on the side, right about where the root collar is, just right at the root collar where the roots are beginning to emerge at the top. It'll just be a little, if you see little, can I use the word protuberance? Just a little knot.
I mean, is it
coming
like
out
like the makings of what they call pups? I mean, is it like a little baby?
That's
pup?
Right. It's a pup. It's a pup. Thank
All
you.
Right.
That's easier. So it's the pup before it's fully a pup, but it'll just be a little knot that wants to be a pup.
Okay.
Very
good.
That's what you're looking for. All right. All right. So, if Dan is out. Dan, where? You're out in a pitcher plant bog. Dan, you're over there. Maybe you're over there looking at the boardwalk. I'm judging you might be over there around. I'm not sure where you are, but. So Dan's sending me lots of pictures, keeping me really occupied. That beautiful pink flower, Dan, is Rexia deer grass. It's a pretty thing, Rexia, R-H-E-X-I-A, sometimes called deer grass, which makes no sense whatsoever why it would be called deer grass, but that's one of the common names for it. I think I would call it urn flower, U-R-N flower, if I had to give it a name. Because the flowers have a base that looks like an urn. It looks like a little urn that you tip and the seeds pour out of it. And then we're going to talk about that white plant when we come back.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Oh, lots of things to think about this morning. I'm working on it. Dan is working on me. Boy, Dan, you got to... He's throwing one thing after me after another. So, Dan, you know, of course, the last picture Dan sent to me is a picture of a beautiful, beautiful white-top pitcher plant, Sarracenia leucophylla, the beautiful white-top pitcher plants there at Weeks Bay Bog. Dan is walking through it, throwing me challenges as he goes. Lots of white-top pitcher plants. The things that look like white stars, it's a type of sedge. We call it white-top sedge, star sedge, maybe some people call it. It's actually it's a sedge, and it's unusual that sedges are that showy, but these are white top sedges, and they can be very, very showy right now. They're really showy at Weeks Bay. Dan is really enjoying them as he goes through. So there it is, a really good thing. You know, I'm thinking, because we had the question about whether we could use a creeping phlox as a ground cover here, and on the Gulf Coast. And no, I don't recommend it. People sell them to you, but they're not going to survive well. They just don't like the wet soils on the Gulf Coast. There are a lot of berry dwarf plants that grow on the Gulf Coast, but they grow in special conditions. They're not going to grow in the kind of conditions we have in our yard. One of the problems when it comes to, listen, here's a problem with dwarf plants and that make a mat. They're either toxic, and there are a few that are toxic. I mean, they just are such an obnoxious thing that you can't deal with them. They actually put out chemicals that stop other plants from growing, and they're pretty difficult to deal with. Or they're going to get lots of weeds and other things coming up, and they may not be evergreen all year long. Here's a tentative recommendation. And we can talk about it. We can talk about it a little more next week if you want to as well. If I had to cover an area next to the house, and I wanted something with a lot of color all year long that looked really good, or at least all during the growing season, I think I would do this. I would use two different plants. The first thing I would do is in that space, I would, for most of the summer season, I would depend on coleus, because coleus have such showy leaves, and we have such a long, long growing season, and you want color from March, from the end of February through the 1st of December, that is a nothing blooms that consistently for that long a period. I mean, that's 10 months out of the year. But coleus, the leaves themselves are gorgeous. Look for some coleus that you really love the color of the leaves. Get those coleus. It's really easy to propagate coleus to cover a huge area. You may have to replant it every spring, but you don't have to buy the new plants every spring. I can tell you how. It's very easy. You just take cuttings, you put them in a little jar, put them on the windowsill, and then you plant them out again during the spring. It's very easy. So coleus make a great ground cover. Find the ones that are not as tall if you want something a little tighter. There are a lot of them like that, but I like the ones that are about knee-high. They're absolutely gorgeous. They're stunning. They make a great ground cover. That's a beautiful thing. And then during winter, we can talk about there are a lot of plants that you can put in that will occupy that space during winter that will be very pretty, from things like Sweet William to just a whole bunch of other plants. Not only sweet, but pansies and other things like that can occupy that space in winter. So give me a call. Let's talk about if that works for you, because that may be the best solution. And Dan, you're keeping me occupied. You hadn't beat me yet, though, Dan. I'm going to catch up with you. Ross, before I have to occupy myself with Dan's questions again.
I love your show. Question, I have some beautiful dwarf gardenias that became larger due to being runoff, probably fertilizer from the golf course, okay? But they were beautiful. They became larger than normal. And then my renter at that house butchered them back. I mean, like, you wouldn't believe butchered them. And they're ugly. I mean, scraggly, ugly. What should I do? Should I just pull them up and replace them, or maintain them and let them grow back, or what?
Ross, first off, tell me how large they got before they cut them back.
They got, I'm going to guesstimate, 2 feet, maybe 2.5 feet high, and very, very spread out, bushy. I mean, it was like a hedge.
Yeah, so you're one of the few people who's ever had dwarf gardenias that actually did well, and I'm guessing that they are dwarf gardenias. They just are happy in that situation for whatever reason.
They got a lot of fertilizer, I think, off the golf course. Not to mention, I had nice grass back there when I lived there, and and it's running downhill to them, so they got a lot of fertilizer. Yeah,
and the shade might have been nice as well. Maybe there's a little shade there that's kind of perfect.
Actually not.
Really?
But now during the heat of the day, no shade. But in the afternoon, all shade. Yeah.
So that helped it a lot. But that's unusual that the dwarf gardenias did that well. Here's what I will say. I think they're going to resprout, and they're going to do just fine. There's nothing you can do to trim them. Just let them grow back. They'll grow back pretty quickly. They probably cut them back at just the wrong time. I'm curious, why would somebody cut something back at 2.5 feet?
Well, that's a good question, but from what I've heard, she, the mother, had young kids, and she was afraid of critters being in those bushes.
I see. Isn't that so? It is. It is really weird, isn't it?
It is really weird. I couldn't believe it. And not only that, but somehow they killed all my monkey grass that bordered my whole front yard. It was ridiculous.
That is.
I mean, I had beautiful monkey grass bordering, and they killed it too. I don't understand. I mean, honestly, they treated my house inside perfectly, even better than expected, but the outside looks like crap.
I don't know how they kill monkey grass.
That's what I asked them. How do you kill monkey grass?
I think people are going to be happier on Mars. And maybe we should just all go live on Mars, because people are scared to death of everything. You know, I don't know what alien space creature is going to be up there that they're going to try to trim out of existence. But, you know, it's crazy. I mean, we grew up. Isn't it a shame that kids can't even get to enjoy critters anymore? Because mamas are afraid a critter's going to eat them. And yeah. What's going to eat their kids aren't the critters. It's going to be something else, you know?
I had a beautiful climbing flag on now, they were good renters as far as tame and inside.
Yeah,
yeah. The guy just couldn't take care of the yard. And I had it immaculate. Three years ago.
So I'm curious how they got.
Let the gardenias go and let them just.
Yeah, drive. Just let them go. They'll be fine. They'll be fine, and they'll come back just fine. I think I'm amazed that they were doing as well as they were doing.
Yeah, well, I was too. I mean, I bought the door for a reason, and I had to shave them because I couldn't see the golf course over them.
that's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, I think they're going to come back just fine. I think they're going to be just fine.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Yep. Hey, Vanna, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, I just wondered what you thought about the vine Mandevilla. Will it winter here well, or will I have to cover it up if I plant it straight in the ground?
You know, here's what I think. I'm a sucker for Mandevilla, and particularly the white ones. I really like them, Alamandas, Mandevillas, the whole group of them. They can be very pretty, and I really like them. They're really useful. They're not going to overwinter most years. It would be a very rare year that they would overwinter. So, I haven't tried to preserve them from cuttings, but there may be a way to do that. Maybe you could even dig them up and put them in a pot, or... You know, the easier thing to do is just to buy them every year because you like them. and you know, it's really easy to do, and they grow very fast. And the great thing is, you know, you're going to get 10 months out of them. And then, you know, at some point about mid-December, there's going to be a cold spell that goes blam and knocks them back. And then there'll be something in January that makes sure they're dead. So it's just what happens with them. But they're really nice plants.
Well, I might try it one year and just cover them with what I usually cover everything else and see if it works.
That's an idea. And it may work. It may well work. You know, I keep peppers alive year to year just by covering them, and at least some types of peppers. And it may work with Mandevilla, so give it a try. But they're great plants. Generally, they wouldn't overwinter.
One other question,
though.
And you can answer it later if you want in a hurry. It's a product called Better Than Rocks that's made from recycled plastic, and you cut portions of it and put it in the bottom of your pot instead of putting pebbles.
Bad idea. We'll come back and talk about it. Okay. Never heard of it, but I can tell you it don't work. And I'll tell you why. We'll be back. Dan, you ain't going to beat me on this, man. I'm gonna identify every one of them plants that you sent me. David, that's a beautiful coleus. I think I know which one it is. It's really nice. Hey, give us a call, 251-343-0106. We don't have much time left, so give us a call.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So let's talk about pots of drainage. There's a physics issue, and that is that water clings to anytime water you go from one surface to another, when there's a change in texture of surfaces, water clings to the denser surface. This sounds crazy, but think about a sponge. Vanna, think about a sponge. She called me about this product, a new product that, you know, doesn't do miracle things. Think about a sponge. A sponge, you wet it, you push you know, you pull it out of the water, and a lot of water pours out of it. But you know what happens? Unless you squeeze it really tight, there's still a lot of water in that sponge. So all the water seems to drain out, but what holds the water in the sponge? It's this capillary action. It's this thing that, you know, it's kind of a gravitational pull that holds that water, it's a little more complicated than that, holds the water to the tighter surface. So the water could just drain right out into the air, but it doesn't, right? So the old idea was, well, I can't get the water in my soil, in my container, to drain. It won't drain. So I'm going to put rocks in the bottom because there's air around the rocks, and the water will just go right out through those rocks. Well, it didn't happen because it's just like that sponge, right? It's just like the sponge. The water still clings to the denser surface, which is the soil, because it's much denser than the rocks. You know, that's the way things are. It's just the way things are. So all of these mats and other things that are designed to promote better drainage, you know, they would have to be denser than the soil, but you still have that interface where it isn't working. So basically, all you're doing when you put something in your pot is it means you're putting less soil in there. And there's less soil for those roots to grow in. And less soil for the water to... And at the bottom of every pot, it's almost inevitable. At the bottom of every pot, there's a place where it's too wet. It's too wet for the roots to grow because the drainage isn't good. How do you fix this? Well, one thing we want to have is we do want to make sure that initial water has plenty of places to drain. I like putting holes around the sides of a pot so that if the hole in the bottom gets clogged up, you won't hold water there. At least you get that initial water. But having a deeper pot makes a lot of difference in how plants survive. Because the deeper pots, they just assume that there's going to be a layer that stays perpetually too wet because the texture changes between the pot. And to me, the best thing is to have a pot that is, for example, water moves from soil to a clay pot that isn't glazed very well. So clay pots can be pretty good about taking some of that extra moisture out at the bottom, particularly if there's air circulation, and just they can be pretty good about drawing some of that moisture out of the soil. But the rocks don't work, and those fiber things don't work. Charlie, have we got another caller? Tony, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill. Hey, Charlie.
Hey.
Hey, we started using soaker hoses. We started this, several months back, and we put them on a timer. And, man, that seems to do so much better with our garden. But right now, it feels like I'm growing tomatoes to feed the worms.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm having a heck of a time with the worms. I'm out here every day picking them off. And they're just, right now, they're attacking the tomato, fruit itself.
Yes, yeah, so here it is. That's right. So now you've got tomato worms. Here's and tomato fruit worms, and yep. and Dan had sent me this picture too. This is a job for BT.
I've been doing that,
and they're still coming at you. How many times? Yep. How frequently?
I'm at war with these things, but the third side has helped, no doubt about it. But,
yeah.
Right now, they just seem to be attacking the fruit and not the leaves so much.
That's right.
Whenever they do eat part of a tomato and you pull the worm off, would you just let the tomato just keep growing or go ahead and pull it?
Well, that's a tough question because we do have lots of other, because our climate is really good for making punky diseases around those wounds. And
yep, that's what I was worried about.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure it's worthwhile. Keep working on them with the BT. You're probably going to have to reapply the BT about every 3 or 4 days this time of year. Look for those little eggs in the tips of the leaves. They're going to be there. You can sometimes just peel those eggs off. And the big ones, the bigger ones, listen, Tony, the big ones, nothing kills them except your fingers.
Thank you. So that's what we've been doing. Thank you.
Take a pair of pliers, pull them off.
Got it, man. Thank you.
Folks, it's been good. Dan, you beat me. I couldn't get to all of them, but I know what they are. Send me pictures next week. I'll identify them all for you. We got lots of calls, lots of pictures. John, send me that picture again next week. We'll talk about it. Talk to you next week, folks.
Not for you.